radiofonica.com.
Welcome to Short Science, your international, era-spanning portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke. Today, we're going to be looking into outer space. Well, to be more precise, we're going to be looking at our efforts to look into outer space, examining what has been explored so far and how advanced technology might help us to get further. Plus, we'll be hearing from Ed Prosser as he takes a look back at the Apollo 14 mission to the moon. This is Short Science. So hello and welcome to the show. Now, you might have noticed that there have been some big changes here on Short Science in the last few weeks. Now, we are no longer broadcasting on Imperial College Radio. Well, why not? Well, the studio has got into such a state of disrepair that it doesn't actually work anymore. Now, you might have noticed the deteriorating sound quality in our shows since around December. Now, that was due to equipment and maintenance failure in the studio. And we don't like to do bad radio. And some weeks this year, we haven't even been able to broadcast at all, let alone badly. So to protect our broadcasts and to keep them as high quality as possible, we've decided to move to a brand new station. Now we've invested in new studio equipment, some of which I'm using to record today. And this new station will be broadcasting Short Science online several times per week. So what is this new station then? Well, I can't tell you too much yet. Tense negotiations are still ongoing. No, it's not actually anything that serious. But things aren't completely firmed up yet. But what I can tell you is that it's another online radio station, so you'll be able to listen to the show from anywhere in the world. And you'll be able to listen to the show live or via Listen Again links, just as with IC Radio. So keep listening over the coming weeks for more details. Other exciting news is that we've got a very special show planned for Wednesday the 2nd of March. Now I'm going to be joined in the Short Science studio by a very special surprise guest presenter, new to the Short Science airwaves. Now the only clue that I'm going to give you is that the show will be all about inheritance. So don't miss out on what promises to be a very exciting and unusual show. But before we get back to today, let's briefly look ahead to next week. We'll have the fantastic Katie Draper in the co-presenter's chair and we'll be tackling the topic of HTML. We'll be looking at the very stuff the internet is made of, examining HTML, HTML5, the internet code of the future, and how things like this affect Flash, iPhones and Apple Mac computers. Now, it's a bit of a mind-bending topic, but we're going to get the facts straight and simple to find out what really goes on behind our pretty web pages. Now, if you have anything to say about internet code, using Flash applications or not being able to use them, for example on the iPhone, then we'd love to hear from you. Also, if there's a question you've always wanted answered, we'll do our very best. Now, the number you need to call to get your voice on air is +44 7401 856 681. That's 07401 856 681. You just need to call in by next Tuesday, record your message, and we'll play it out live on air on Wednesday's show. And we do promise to play out each and every message, so don't hold back, get calling. And you can also email material into the studio. The address is studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, let's get back to today's show. It's time for the Short Science News in Brief. Sheep lunch on TNT. Murray Craig, a scientist at Oregon State University, has found that cud-chewing mammals, such as sheep, can effectively clean up soil that is contaminated with explosives. In America, it's estimated that there is about 1.3 million tons of contaminated soil from military testing grounds and munitions factories. And while this explosive residue doesn't pose a threat to health, there is the risk that it could leach into the water supply or poison plants. Now, conventional cleanup techniques involve incineration, which is costly and time-consuming. Grass planted in the soil instead sucks up the explosive, and as the grass is broken down by bacteria in the sheep's digestive system, the explosive is also broken down. and there is absolutely no danger of the sheep exploding at a later date, as the explosive is completely neutralised in the gut. Zinc effective in tackling the common cold. The severity and duration of a cold can be lessened by taking zinc syrup, tablets or lozenges. A large Cochrane systematic review looking at data from 15 different trials concluded that there is evidence that taking zinc within the first day of cold symptoms speeds up recovery. There's also evidence that zinc may help to protect against colds. However, too much zinc can be dangerous to our health, causing nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain and diarrhea. It appears that the zinc does help to stop the cold virus from replicating and causing illness, but until more evidence is gathered on safe dosing, doctors are recommending that we don't take zinc regularly. Shrinking chips. Engineers have developed tiny nanowires that can carry out computing functions depending on the application of tiny electrical currents. This means that computer chips can be built up from tiny components instead of needing to be etched out of solid chunks of material. As reported in Nature, this approach may outpace the shrinking of chips made with current manufacturing techniques. These nanowires are made of germanium surrounded by a silicon shell and are thousands of times smaller than a human hair. Survival instinct makes malaria deadly. Scientists from Edinburgh University claim that malaria is particularly deadly because it has to battle other infections for survival. When malaria enters our bloodstream, it alters its plan of attack depending on the competition from other types of malaria. Now, normally malaria enters the body and replicates, forming cells that can be taken up by other feeding mosquitoes to spread the disease. However, in the presence of other strains of malaria, the replication process produces infection-causing cells rather than infection-spreading cells, meaning that the individual will be more severely affected by the disease. Barn owls can't take the cold. Experts say that the number of barn owl deaths has increased threefold as a result of the cold winter. In December alone, more than 100 birds were found dead. Now, barn owls are not built for cold weather and their hunting skills rely on their light weight, which is not ideal for keeping them warm in freezing conditions. If our harsh winters continue, the barn owl could go into decline across the UK. Problem drinking on the increase. Alcohol Concern estimates that the number of people seeking hospital admission for alcohol-related problems could increase to 1.5 million per year by 2015, costing the NHS £3.7 billion per year. Now, the Department of Health has said that it will publish a new alcohol strategy this year amid calls for alcohol specialists to be deployed in all hospitals and GP practices. Prairie dogs caught showboating. Researchers at St. Louis Zoo in the US have reported that the behaviour of prairie dogs changes when they're being observed by human audiences. The scientists spent several months recording the behaviour of black-tailed prairie dogs and correlated this with the numbers of human onlookers in the visiting enclosure. The greater the number of humans in the audience, the less time the adults spent looking out for danger. Instead, they spent more time being affectionate with each other and kissing. However, the younger prairie dogs seemed to become tense with a greater audience, spending more time fighting. Researchers had expected the prairie dogs to become more vigilant with an audience, so their romantic kissing and grooming behaviours have come as a bit of a surprise. And finally today, children at risk of rickets. Our modern preoccupation with protecting ourselves and our children from the dangers of sun exposure is inadvertently causing vitamin D deficiency in children and exposing them to the risk of the deforming bone disease rickets. Doctors at Southampton General Hospital have seen a resurgence of the disease in recent years. Now, vitamin D is created in the skin when it's exposed to ultraviolet light or sunlight. Only tiny amounts of vitamin D can be gained from the diet, so this light exposure is very important. Without vitamin D, our bodies cannot process calcium and phosphorus properly, and our bones can therefore not grow and mature or maintain their normal strength. Well, that's it for our science news today. If you've got any comments or questions about any of our stories, then give us a call on 07401 856 681 or drop us an email. The address is studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, as we're looking at space exploration today, let's see what space stories have been hitting the headlines recently. Stardust Probe reviews Comet Crater. Back in 2005, the comet Tempel 1 was visited by a space probe that fired a projectile at the surface of the comet to disturb the surface. Now, this left a crater on the surface of Tempel 1 that's still visible today. A recent flyby by NASA's Stardust spacecraft has given us an up-to-date view of that same crater. And it appears that there has been some remodeling of the site. The edges now look much softer than before. It appears that the surface of the crater was very fragile, and as the ice thrown up by the impact has landed back on the surface, there's been some healing of the crater. The Stardust probe took 70 high-resolution pictures of the crater, and instruments analysed the dust surrounding the comet. Now, Stardust was originally launched in 1999 with the goal of visiting another comet, Wild 2. It did that in 2004, and with fuel remaining in the tanks, NASA retasked the probe to investigate Tempel 1. This meant that the Tempel 1 flyby cost only $29 million, compared to an estimated $300 to $500 million for a new mission. The comet is currently about 336 million kilometres from Earth, and the radio messages from the probe took about 18 minutes to travel back. Technical problems have delayed freighter launch. Europe was due to launch the Johannes Kepler robotic truck on board the Ariane rocket yesterday. But with just 4 minutes left of the launch countdown, the mission was aborted. Telemetry had suggested a problem with the Ariane fueling system. The European Space Agency truck was due to be the heaviest ever payload that Ariane has taken into space and was carrying food, fuel, air, and equipment to the International Space Station. The freighter was also tasked with pushing the space station to a greater altitude, as it has a tendency to drop over time. Now, due to the delay in the Johannes Kepler launch, NASA's Discovery launch will also be delayed further. Both space vessels rely on the same satellites to relay data and therefore cannot be in flight at the same time. Funding to encourage private space development. President Barack Obama has requested more money for the development of private space vehicles. NASA's budget has been frozen and it's retired its fleet of spacecraft. It will now be relying on Russian craft to take its astronauts into space for the time being. However, with the development of the private sector, it is hoped that routine space travel will use commercial crafts, leaving NASA to devote more of its budget to developing spacecraft for deep space exploration. NASA scientists design new crafts. So while funds are thin on the ground at NASA and plans for further space exploration are decades away, two engineers have designed concept crafts capable of realising exploration of Mars. Now, the Nautilus X MMSEV, or Non-Atmospheric Universal Transport Intended for Lengthy United States Exploration Multi-Mission Space Exploration Vehicle, is one such design. Now, this vehicle could support a crew of six for up to 2 years, with estimates that travelling to Mars would take 8 to 9 months each way. To help protect the health of the astronauts, there is a habitable centrifuge ring to provide artificial gravity. The craft would be formed of a number of modules, both rigid and inflatable, docking stations, manipulator arms, landing craft, a hydroponic farm, and solar panels. It could also be made up over time. Initially, it could be launched as a way station between the Earth and the Moon. Then propulsion modules could be added to allow it to travel further into space. And the estimated cost for this little gem? Well, about $3.7 billion spent over 5 years. Mars simulation. Well, talking of visiting Mars, two men wearing spacesuits have walked across a sandpit at a Moscow Institute in Mars mission simulation. Of course, I do this without the spacesuit every time I visit the park, but these guys really believed in what they were doing. Now, the astronauts, in inverted commas, have spent the last 8 months with four other people locked away in a series of windowless tubes representing a spacecraft. The Mars 500 project was designed to find out how the human mind and body would cope with a long-duration spaceflight. Now, life in the Mars 500 project is different to being on the International Space Station, where crafts and people come and go, and there's a constant communication with Earth. In the Mars 500 virtual craft, all communications have been delayed by 20 minutes to simulate deep space flight, and the astronauts have to continuously complete experimental tasks. Now, there are plans to transfer the project to the International Space Station to allow the virtual astronauts to experience weightlessness during their participation. Or should that be incarceration? Well, anyway, that's what's been happening this week in the world of space exploration. So we're going to move on now to have a look at just what we know about the moon. So let's start off by considering how we see and experience the moon from Earth. Now, we never see the moon looking the same on two consecutive nights because, as we know, our view of the moon is constantly cycling between new moon, meaning we see nothing, to full moon, meaning we see the moon as a circular disk. So why does this happen? Well, we only see the moon because we can see light from the sun being reflected off the surface of the moon and back towards Earth. Now, it takes the moon 27.3 days to orbit the Earth. So each night of those 27.3 days, the moon is in a different position relative to the Earth and the sun. However, because the Earth is also orbiting the sun, it actually takes the moon 29.5 days to get back to the same position relative to the sun. Now, when the moon is between the Earth and the sun, it's the dark, unlit side of the moon that faces us, so we see nothing at all, and that is a new moon. Now, the side of the moon that's bathed in light from the sun is facing away from the Earth, so we just can't see it. As the moon then moves around the Earth, we start to see more of the moon in an increasing crescent shape, night by night. And when the moon is on the opposite side of the Earth to the sun, we see the whole surface that's facing the sun, a full moon. Now, the other phenomenon that we know about here on Earth is that of tidal pull. So every sea and ocean in the world has two high tides per day, due to the gravitational pull of the moon and the sun. Now, there is also a tidal movement of the solid surface of the Earth of about half a metre. Now, the reasons for all this are a bit complicated to work out, but if you consider that the Earth has a centre of gravity and it rotates around this, so if there was nothing else with any gravity, there would be no tides or outward bulging of any surface of the Earth. Every part of the spherical Earth would be experiencing the same amount of gravity. But the moon also has a centre of gravity. And the way this interacts with our planet is that there is a sort of average centre of gravity that's formed from both the gravity on Earth and on the moon. Now, this average centre of gravity isn't in the centre of the Earth. It's actually sort of off-centre, which means that as the Earth rotates during 24 hours, different parts of the Earth are near and far from this off-centre average point of gravity, creating tides. And the same thing happens with the sun and the Earth, meaning that there are two tidal movements per day. So let's move on to think about what we can see of the moon from the Earth. Well, the moon always keeps the same side facing the Earth as it orbits. So without going into space and looking around the back of the moon, we can only see half of the moon's surface. Now, early astronomers saw dark patches on the surface of the moon, which they thought were seas. And they gave them names like Mirae. Now, we know that these areas are formed of solid lava, and there never was any water in them. And these lava craters were formed when asteroids hit the moon early in its history, forming these giant pools of lava. And as it cooled down, darker rocks called basalts were formed. Now, the lighter areas on the surface are the highlands of the moon, and they are largely formed of anorthosite. Now, the moon has no atmosphere to protect it and no magnetic field to deflect electrically charged particles from the sun. So the surface is continuously bombarded with micrometeorites, cosmic rays, and the solar wind. And this has caused the surface of the moon to break up into a fine rubble-like substance called regolith. Now, it's a bit like soil, except that it's just made up of rock and minerals. Now, the surface rocks are continuously being bombarded and changed by cosmic rays. Now, these are mostly very high-speed protons, helium and carbon nuclei. Now, this means that these rocks contain a history of all the cosmic ray and solar activity over the last 5 billion years. So, what do we know about the structure of the moon? Well, the outer layer, like on Earth, is called the crust, and below that there is the mantle. Now, on the moon, the crust is about 60 to 110 kilometres thick, except at one point that we know about, the Mare Crisium, a really, really deep crater where there is barely any crust at all. Now, the crust and solid upper mantle form the lithosphere, which is about 1,000 kilometres thick. Now, below this is the asthenosphere, which is probably partly liquid. And then the moon has an iron-rich core that is about 700 kilometres in diameter. So let's finish off now by thinking about where the moon came from. Now, there are four theories about this. The first idea is that the moon was fully formed somewhere else in the solar system, but the Earth captured it into orbit. Now, this would have been really tricky because the moon would have had to be travelling at exactly the right speed, in exactly the right direction for the Earth to have captured it. And also, the composition of rocks on the surface of the moon and on the Earth are too similar to have occurred by coincidence in two completely different parts of the solar system. So George Darwin came up with the idea that the moon might have split off from the Earth. The Earth may have been spinning so fast that a small part bulged out and then broke off, forming the moon. However, there is no evidence that we were ever spinning that fast, or anything else in the solar system for that matter. So what about the idea that the Earth and the moon formed out of the same cloud of gas or dust? Well, if that were the case, it's a little bit weird that the moon has an ecliptic orbit, and also that the Earth is 1.6 times as dense as the moon, because if they were made of the same stuff, you'd think they'd have the same density. And finally, maybe the moon was formed from a giant impact. Now, this is the favourite theory. So when the Earth was molten and the heavier elements were concentrated in the core, perhaps a planet the size of Mars collided with the Earth, causing a great big chunk of the crust and mantle to lift off into orbit. And perhaps a bit of crust and mantle from the impacting planet also broke off and went into orbit, mixing to form the moon. Now, this would explain why the surface rocks of the moon and Earth are similar but not identical. It would explain why the surface rocks of the moon lack water and volatile elements, as these would have evaporated into space during that impact. And it also explains the lower density of the moon, as the moon is only formed from the crust and mantle of the Earth, and heavier elements from the Earth's core wouldn't have been included. And finally, it explains why the moon only has a tiny core, because there was very little iron in the Earth's crust and mantle. Well, I think we'd better leave the moon there for a moment. So let's take a quick look now at our exploration of the other planets. So first off, why do we bother to study space at all? Well, looking at other objects in the solar system can tell us more about how the Earth formed. Comets can give us an early snapshot of the solar system. They're sort of like ancient dirty snowballs that still contain materials from the nebula. Now, the nebula was the giant gas, dust and ice cloud from which the solar system formed. Also, looking at different planets tells us even more about how the solar system formed. Different planets are made of different elements in different concentrations. Saturn's rings can tell us a lot about how materials around the newborn sun might have behaved. Okay, so let's have a look at some recent missions and what we hope to learn from them. Now, SMART 1 was the European Space Agency's tester mission for lunar exploration. It ended with a controlled impact on the moon's surface in 2006, and data from this mission is being used to help select potential landing sites for further missions. Mars Express is the European Space Agency's first mission to Mars. Now, it arrived in 2003 and is busy investigating the Martian surface in great detail. Now, a key part of this mission is to find out what happened to all the water that is known to have been abundant on an early Mars. The MRO is NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Now, since 2006, it has been studying the surface, subsurface and atmosphere of the planet. It has been involved in picking up potential landing sites for future missions and areas of interest. And it carries high-resolution wide-angle cameras to take some good snaps of the red planet. Now, NASA's Cassini-Huygens began touring Saturn and its moons in 2004. The Huygens probe separated from Cassini and set off to look at Saturn's moon Titan. Early in 2005, it descended through Titan's thick orange atmosphere to land on the surface of the moon. The Venus Express is another European Space Agency mission to study Venus this time. It's the first spacecraft to visit Venus in over 10 years, and the Venus Express is following an eccentric orbit so that it can take global measurements as well as close-ups. Well, I think that's quite enough on interplanetary missions for the time being. It's time now to see what you at home have been thinking about.
You've got mail.
Well, the first person to get in touch this week was Adrian Giordani. Now, he has been a guest on Short Science before, many episodes ago, in 2009. And now he writes for the online publication International Science Grid This Week. And a couple of weeks ago, he was looking into the idea of using nuclear power to further space travel. So, using a conventional rocket to send astronauts to Mars would take at least 6 months each way. But what about if nuclear fission propulsion were used? Well, a nuclear reactor produces enough energy to propel a craft almost 6 times faster than the chemical rocket engines used today. And as an added bonus, the energy density of nuclear fuel is greater than that of chemical fuel, so less physical fuel would be needed for the same amount of energy. Well, this all does sound very exciting, but what about if something went wrong? Surely there's a massive potential for a nuclear disaster. Well, Stephen Howe, the director of the Centre for Space Nuclear Research, says that the rocket would be launched cold, so the nuclear reactor would only be switched on in high Earth orbit. And the only nuclear material on board would be the small amount of fuel. And there'd be much less chance of an explosion, as there would be no oxygen to react with the hydrogen propellant, as in chemical rockets. So I guess we're going to have to keep our eyes open to hear more about this in the future. Now, also this week, Ed Prosser of the Sounds of Science has been taking a look at the Apollo 14 mission. Let's have a listen to what he has to say.
40 seconds and counting, Alan Shepard reports that he's performing his final guidance alignment, the final maneuver the astronauts perform before liftoff. 30 seconds and counting. Stu Reeser just said, thanks, it's been a good count. 25 seconds and counting, we are still go.
Canary go.
20 seconds, guidance alert, the guidance system now going internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8. Ignition sequence start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Launch commit. Liftoff. We have liftoff. Apollo 14. 3 minutes past the hour. The tower is clear.
Just over 40 years ago, the Apollo 14 crew was on the return leg of their trip to the moon, returning to Earth in the Pacific Ocean on February 9, 1971. After the failure of Apollo 13, it was to be 10 months before NASA attempted to land a crew on the moon with Apollo 14, launching from the Kennedy Space Center on January 31, 1971.
Cabin pressure coming down, adjusting from sea level to a space environment. Status check in mission control and coming up all greens on the flight director's console.
In Houston, everything looks good here on the ground.
Apollo 14 was the 8th manned mission in the Apollo program and the 3rd to take men to the moon. The 9-day mission consisted of crew members Commander Alan Shepard, Command Module Pilot Stuart Reeser, and Lunar Module Pilot Edgar Mitchell. 5 days after setting off, Shepard and Mitchell were to land on the moon, whilst Reeser remained in orbit aboard the command module. However, the lunar landing was not entirely without issue. To make the descent onto the moon's surface, the lunar module had to separate from the command module and then begin its way down onto the moon. Shortly after this occurred, the computer on the lunar module began to receive an abort signal, and this very nearly initiated an auto-abort of the landing. If this had occurred, the lunar module would have separated from its descent stage and began taking the crew back into lunar orbit, and this would have cancelled a very expensive trip to the moon. Mission Control had to find a solution to this problem quickly, and resulted in them instructing Mitchell to manually reprogram the flight software so that it would be able to ignore the erroneous signal, which he did just in the nick of time. As if this wasn't enough, the radar altimeter on the lunar module failed to lock onto the moon's surface. This deprived the navigational computer vital information needed to land the lunar module. So, to remedy this, the crew basically did what you might do when your computer breaks. They unplugged the component that didn't work and then plugged it back in. And in this case, it actually worked. It was later determined that this fault was a consequence of the earlier software updates. After all this, Shepard and Mitchell made it to the moon safely, and we can hear them landing now.
There's good stuff. Roger,
roll. Stretch now.
Okay. 3 feet per second. Contact now.
Two, stop. Three,
four. Auto. We're on the surface.
Okay, we made a good landing.
Roger. And there's 4 feet plus 10,000.
That was a beautiful one.
Yeah, we're slightly off.
And this was the moment the astronauts set foot on the moon for the very first time.
Okay, Al, beautiful. We can see you coming down the ladder right now. It looks like you're about on the bottom step and on the surface. Bedford, old man.
Okay. Shepard's first words when he steps onto the moon's surface were, it's been a long way, but we're here. Whilst on the moon, the crew went out for two moonwalks, the second of which they got very lost on. The crew were attempting to navigate to the rim of a 300-meter-wide crater. In the end, they got so disorientated that they had to turn back. It later turned out they had actually come within 30 meters of the crater without realizing it. They also found time to fit in a spot of golf. Shepard had brought with him a makeshift 6-iron and 2 golf balls, which he single-handedly dispatched into the moon's horizon. And on the second shot, exclaimed that the ball had gone for
miles and miles and miles.
The crew returned to Earth without any problems, splashing down in the Pacific Ocean on February the 9th, 1971. What was also interesting about Apollo 14 is that during the mission, Rusa had brought into space with him several hundred seeds, which on return were planted as commemorative moon trees across America. Apollo 14 also clocked up the longest distance traversed by foot on the lunar surface and was the first to utilize color TV on the moon. Of the three Apollo 14 crew members, Edgar Mitchell is the only one that remains alive today. Stuart Rusa died aged 61 from pancreatitis in 1994. And Alan Shepard died in 1998, aged 74, from leukemia. He was the fifth man to ever walk on the moon.
So thanks ever so much to Ed Prosser for that. Now, if you have any questions about anything we've been talking about today, or if you would like to send in your comments or thoughts, then leave a message on our recording machine at 07401 856 681 or email studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, that's about all we've got time for today. Now, don't forget to get in touch with your thoughts about internet coding. Should it be simpler? Should it be uniform? What about the new launch of HTML5? What about the difficulties with using Flash on your iPhone? Well, if you've got anything to say, call in your message to 07401 856 681 or email studio@shortscience.co.uk. And don't forget to check out shortscience.co.uk, our website, for details of every show, including what's coming up next week. Now, you can find out how to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or listen online to any episode you should so choose. So thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. My name is Elizabeth Hawke, and I was your presenter and producer today. Thanks to Adrian Giordani of online publication International Science Grid this week. Thanks also to Ed Prosser. The theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design. Thank you very much for listening, and join us again next week for another episode of Short Science.
La migliore musica italiana in esclusiva.
Gli artisti emergenti più interessanti.
I live più adrenalinici.
La black music di Piotta.
Il music book di Dario Salvatori.
La musica al femminile di Note Rosa.
Videogames, animazione, cultura moderna.
Tutto questo e molto altro è Ubix, il miglior free press di musica e cultura in circolazione. Da gennaio Ubix arriva in Umbria. Cercalo ogni mese sul web e nelle migliori location della regione.
www.ubixweb.com.
Ubix.
Free press, free spirit, free music. Tourne-toi. Non. Tu es fou. 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 Tu es f
faccio per sognare.
Siamo io e te, e dopo il sesso voglio un cesso, una sigaretta, un carcabè.